Sylvia Stecker of Running with Needles and Scissors is our Fiber Talk guest this week. The show is sponsored by Sassy Jack Stitchery and the Embroiderers Guild of America. If you're looking for the right gift for your favorite needleworker, start at Sassy Jack Stitchery. Gift cards are always a great option because they allow your spouse, partner, or friend to choose from a huge selection of charts, threads, ground cloth options, and stitching accessories. Sassy Jacks has in stock the new Design Collective Christmas book from the publishers of Inspirations magazine and a limited number of copies of the 2023 Whitney Antiques Exhibition Catalog. Either would make a special gift. When you finish shopping at SassyJackStitchery.com, head over to BlackSwansStudios.com and put your name on the Black Swans Studios mailing list. Black Swans is a coalition of like-minded needlework artisans created by Kim Young and Jackie DePlessis that will focus on sharing collected knowledge and skills with today's needleworkers through multiple learning channels. The first event from the studios will be March 19 to 21 in Asheville, North Carolina, and it will feature an impressive museum-quality band sampler from 1747. Registration is now open. An excellent Christmas gift for your favorite stitcher would be a membership or membership renewal to the Embroiderers Guild of America. The EGA and its local chapters offer tremendous information and educational resources for stitchers of all techniques and skill levels. A popular offering is the virtual lecture series, and you can use the code FiberTalk5, that's FiberTalk and the number 5, to get $5 off any upcoming or recorded lecture. The next virtual lecture is Reviving the Art of Embroidery, Lady Victoria Welby, and the founding of the Royal School of Needlework, 1872 to 1881, and it will be presented by Lynn Hulse. Registration is now open through December 15, and the presentation is December 17 at 1 o'clock p.m. Eastern. While you're visiting egausa.org, be sure to explore all that will happen at the 2024 National Seminar Preserving Needle Art, held August 14 to 18 in Atlanta. Registration is now open. You don't want to miss out on one of the best needlework events of the year. Thanks to Sassy Jack Stitchery and the EGA for sponsoring the show, and now our conversation with Sylvia Stecker. Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr, and you are listening to Fiber Talk, the twice-weekly podcast for needlework artists. Our artist this week, from Running with Needles and Scissors, Sylvia Stecker. Sylvia, welcome.
Thank you, Gary. Thank you for asking me to come on.
Oh, appreciate you doing it. I love the way the company name, you know, Running with Scissors. Well, let's not forget about needles. They poke, too. So,
right. If we're going to be doing something dangerous, let's just really be thorough about it, right?
Yeah, get all the weapons in there. Yep.
Exactly.
How did that name come about? Because that is unique. Was it literally just having some fun?
Well, okay, so when I moved back to Germany in 2009, I had a little blog for a while, because everybody had a blog, you know, and so yeah. I wasn't going to miss out. And it was
till we all learned how much work they are, and then...
Right. Yeah. So that's why I call it a little blog, because it's little. And it was sort of this, I came up with the name because I was running all over Europe with my needles and scissors.
Ah, there we go.
So I called it Running with Needles and Scissors. And then I started my floss tube many years later, and I was actually really running. I'd gotten into trail running. Oh. And so I just, yeah, crazy. Yeah. Anyways, I won't talk about that too much. But so I was literally running, you know, and I was doing some races in various places and, you know, of course, always needlework came along. So I was running with my needles and scissors and I just kept it. And when I started my company, of course I kept it, but much regret because it's a long name.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
The website is long, the email is long. You know, so sometimes I say, well, I wish I had a shorter name, but it is what it is.
Yeah. Yeah, as we used to say, that's tough to fit on a business card, yeah.
Yes. Yes, yeah. It is. So, and yeah. No really cute way to abbreviate it either.
No. I saw where you tried a couple times, and yeah, it just doesn't work. So, oh well.
Not so much.
It's memorable, so keep it. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, I got to learn about the trail running. Because now I follow several cyclists, and there's two or three that also do trail running. That's brutal stuff. You do long distance or
yes,
what?
Yes, yes. I started running when I was 52 because I had obviously nothing better to do. And it became a total obsession. I was just running a little bit to lose weight and get fit, because I had this thing where I said, if a doctor tells me I need to lose weight, that's it. I'm going to lose weight. And I had gone to a doctor in Germany. And at the time, he asked me, like, how much do you weigh? He never put me on the scale. He just asked how much I weighed. And I sort of guesstimated in kilos. I wasn't too far off. I was a little high, but not too far off. And he said, oh, Mrs. Stecka, for that weight, you must grow a little bit, is what he said to me. So, you know, very German. And I was like, all right, that's it. I am taking off some weight. And I did. And so I started running and then discovered trail running and really got into it. I lived in a beautiful area with hills and woods. And, you know, I could run 5 minutes and I was in the woods. And I got this crazy idea about a year in that I would like to do an alpine trail run in my medium old age, and found a trainer and started training for the like the kickoff race, which starts at the bottom of Innsbruck, and then there's all kinds of distances, and I picked the 25 kilometer one through the Alps, up the Alps and back down the Alps. And
so that's what, 14, 50 miles, something like that?
It's a little bit more than a half marathon.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I, you know, I trained on my own, checked in with the trainer, followed his schedule. We would meet up once a month, the running group. And I'm 5'7". And I, again, more so like 53, 54, I think I was. And it was nothing but guys in their 30s that towered over me. And, you know, here I come and I'm like the grandma in this group. And I know they're all groaning inwardly, like, we're going to have to wait on her. Right. But I tell you, the last training run we did was a 25 kilometer run. And there were five of us. One guy didn't finish. I finished second. Ooh. And they never did have to wait on me.
Take that.
Right, right. But in the middle of it, this is very German. In the middle of it, we were running this trail and we passed a guest, you know, a Gasthaus, you know, somewhere where you sit down and have a beer outside. And, you know, they have food. So the trainer goes, let's take a break. Let's have a beer. And so we sat and had a beer, and I'm going, I didn't bring any money. You know, I didn't know you take breaks in the middle of a run.
I came to run. Yeah.
Right. And so we did. We had a 20 minute beer and then we went on, you know. And I thought, I'm training completely wrong. I'm like killing myself here. But then I did do the Innsbruck run. It was a highlight. I finished it. Not everybody managed to finish. I think I finished like in 3 hours and 33 minutes, something like that. I was somewhere in there.
That's pretty good. My daughter runs half marathons, and she just did one a few weeks ago, and it was the first time she'd done a sub 2 hour. So you're doing trail running half marathon in 3 hours. That's impressive. Wow.
Right. In the Alps. So we had,
no, I know. That's what, yeah. I mean, it's that's so not just your level farmland here.
Oh, but I could not move after I was done. And we had to walk back to the car, and it was, you know, a couple hundred meters. And all I could say over and over was, where's the car? Where's the car? Cause I was so tired. And I immediately crawled into bed and, you know, went to sleep. That was it for me. But it was a really fantastic experience. And I did a few others. And at that point, after a few other, like, there were medium races, but all trail running and you know, all very hilly, nothing alpine or anything. Yeah. My body just told me, like, you know what? You're done. You don't need to be doing this. And really had some, you know, hip and back problems and was paying my price, and then just said, okay, you know what? I'm going to have to stop this. But it was great while it lasted. And I had so much fun. And it, you know, any runner will tell you, it just becomes an obsession. You know, you need to go out there and run. And had a little bit of, you know, grieving when I gave it up. I still have all my gear because I'm not quite unhopeful, but I just turned 60 this year and, you know, I don't think it's going to happen again. So it was fun.
No, I do the I do cycling, long distance cycling,
and oh yeah,
3-4 hours on a bike is my escape, and
right.
But yeah, that doesn't beat up the hips and knees quite like running does. No,
not quite that
okay.
Way.
I know this is supposed to be about needlework, but
right.
I got to learn. So when you're doing trail running, the first thing I think of is footing and ankles and knees that get twisted and sprained, and is it just training and learning to be light on your feet? And I mean, how do you not step on a rock and put yourself on the ground?
I've done it once.
Okay.
So I fell once, really injured my knee. This was before I did the Alpine run. And I was told, you're not going to be running on that knee anymore. And I was, and I was really bummed. And I went to work, and I worked for a ministry over in Germany. And I was telling another sporty coworker, I said, you know, they basically said, I can't run on this knee anymore. And he just looked at me and he said, well, he goes, they have not factored in God. And I was like, you know what? You are actually right. You are right. They haven't, you know? And so I did my best to rehab the knee and put it in God's hands. And I said, you know, if you want me to run, then you'll let me run. And if you don't want me to run, then please make that clear to me. And when I decided, like, oh, I might want to do this Alpine run, actually, I had an inflamed Achilles heel and my knee, same leg, you know, and so I was limping. And I'm like, I think I want to do this. And I said, Lord, could you allow me to do this? And he really did. And you know, I said, I have to be healed to a certain point where I could possibly tackle the training. And we got there. He actually gave me a verse at the end of the year. And, you know, when I read that verse, I was like, oh, he's going to make it possible for me to run. And he did. And then when we were done, you know, basically we were done. So yeah. He let me do it. He let me run a couple more races. And he said, all right, you know, I have other
stop.
Things to do. So that was that. But there is a incredible connection, brain-foot connection,
mm-hmm.
and your eyes are just scanning, you know, like 5-6 feet ahead as you're running,
okay.
and noting the territory, and your feet will find it.
Mm-hmm.
And I never really worried about, you know, where my feet landed. The way I fell was, I was running down a washed out trail and there was a rock sticking out and I just didn't pick my foot up high enough to get over that rock and banged my toe right into the tip of the rock. And it was going downhill, you know, and so I just, you know, did a header and hit my knee on a very sharp rock and I punctured my bursa on top of the knee and probably did, you know, and did some damage behind it and cried and limped home or didn't actually limp home. I only limped to the point where my husband could pick me up because there was so much blood running down my leg that I was embarrassed to walk through town. I would have to walk through town, you know, and the Germans aren't very shy about like, what happened to you? You know, I didn't want to deal with that. And so I called him to come get me. I said, I'm down at the bench over here, you know, boo hoo hoo. And, he came with his defender. He could go into the woods with that thing. And so he came and got me and, you know, took me. I said, we're going to have to go to the hospital. So,
wow.
Yeah, totally different story. But, yep, so that was the one time, you know, the eye foot coordination didn't work. But other than that, I never had a problem.
Okay, so then from my perspective as a cyclist, riding, when I ride off-road on trails or gravel roads or whatever, then it's always your eye scanning to pick the line that's going to be cleanest. So you're just doing that with your feet then.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, or like where are the roots? Where is a spot I can plant my foot? And the little bit of training I did in trail running, when they taught us to run downhill, I mean, it was like lean forward and let yourself be pulled downhill.
Really?
You know, and just, you know, just go.
Wow.
You know, and here I am, 53, 54, going, you know, going, oh my gosh, no, this is not my idea of, you know, safety first. But it's a practice thing, and you can, you know, it's sort of like that, I don't know if he's still alive, that guy that did all that free climbing up the side.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and he would just go as fast, you know, and you're like, how is he even, you know, where's his hands and how does he know? And it's, I don't know. I think it's just a, you know, your brain is so amazing and observant, you know, that you're not conscious of everything you're seeing and everything you're processing at that time. And, you know, it obviously works because lots and lots of people trail run and, you know, run downhill and, you know, the hospitals aren't quite full of us crazy people, you know, doing something like that. Or bicyclists, you know, you have to, I mean, it's a very fast process.
Yeah.
You know, when you're going.
Right.
Yeah.
Fascinating. Oh, yeah. I admire the trail runners because it does not look easy at all. No. Nope.
It's fun. It's yeah. fun. It's because you're really, it's not this flat, you know, straight marathon, street running.
Right. Right.
It's a challenge. It's you're on, you're engaged, you know, your brain is just in it the whole time. Right. And I find that fascinating.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I guess that's the part for me is, yeah, you can't just go out there and just put your mind in neutral and just run.
No,
you have to be on it all the time. Yeah. Or you'll end up on the ground. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Excellent. Okay, that ends the athletic portion of our show.
Okay. Because where we're going is not quite athletic.
No, it's not. All right, so what is the German connection?
So my dad was in the German Air Force. And so he's German. I'm German. I was born over there. My mom is American. And I lived there until shortly after 15. And then, much to our distress, I have two brothers. So we're very close in age, you know, so we're all teenagers. And the announcement came that we were moving to the States. And that was just the worst thing that could have happened to us at
as
the time.
Teenagers?
As teenagers, oh. Yes. Oh. And we got to move to El Paso, Texas, which, you know.
Yeah.
Anyways. Coming from, you know, a nice middle-sized German city down to El Paso, Texas. You know, in the long run, that was really a blessing, I think, for all of us. But in the short run, as teens and losing your friends and, right. you know, back in the 70s, early 80s, you know, it was letter writing. And if you wanted to call, you better save up your allowance money.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? So, yeah, it was very traumatic for all of us, kids when we moved to the States. And the schooling is very different. You know, we came out of the German school system, which was at that time still very excellent, and went into the American school system. And one of the reasons, you know, people say, well, why do you speak English so well? It's like, 'cause that's all I had to do. When I moved to the States, was I had to learn English because everything else I'd already done that I was encountering in high school.
So you were that far advanced that it was just a matter of learning language then.
Exactly.
Wow.
Yeah. So wow. The 4 years or the three years that I was in high school, I think once I got to calculus, I was like, oh, okay, now it's getting a little difficult. Because really, we'd done everything prior to that, and all the sciences, you know, and one of the reasons they can do that in Germany is because they do divide you into academic groups. Basically, there's three different schools. You get sorted essentially, and you know, you go to the general school or the medium hard school or the university track school, mm-hmm. and so. You know, they can move at a different pace.
Yeah.
In learning.
Oh, but still as teenagers, oh, what trauma.
I know. And then I did it to my kids, but the reverse. So.
Oh, okay. If it happened to me, it's happening to you. Okay.
right. But they got to move to Germany, which was, you know, in essence then for them. Once they figured out, you know, all the freedoms they had over there, they were quite happy. So
oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, but so you keep the German connection. You keep up even to this day, then.
Yes, my dad is still alive.
Oh, okay.
And lives in Germany. And so when we moved back, my husband, who was a reservist in the Army, got a full-time position over there. And so we moved. It was supposed to be for a year or two. And I said, well, we'll still come with the kids and, you know, it'll be a great exposure. And we stayed 12. And it was great. But leaving my dad was really, really hard. So we left in 2021. And he's 85 now. And, you know, he's healthy, but he's very frail.
Yeah.
So that made it really hard. And there is no family, in essence, over there. None of, like, my brothers are here, and now I'm back here in the States. So that makes it difficult.
So he's the last one left over there, then?
In essence, yes, he is.
Yeah.
And he's married, and his my stepmom takes really excellent care of him. You know, they have no desire to come to the States or anything like that. So they are very much German, you know. Yeah.
Not leaving the motherland. Okay.
Right. Yeah.
Is that where the cross stitch came in? Is that where you learned it, in Germany?
No, I did not. Back when I was in school, in elementary school, you learned to knit.
Okay.
That is one thing they taught you in elementary school. So I was a knitter for many, many years, and all the way into college, and didn't discover cross stitch until after college, when one of my friends got married in Germany, my lifelong friend, and I thought it would be so cool to make her a wedding sampler. And I bought this kit with Ada and, you know, all that good stuff. And I think eventually it landed in the trash. So that's how that one went. And I never finished it. But the first real cross stitch, not even that was real cross stitch, but the first project that I did finish was possibly in 2005. I can't remember exactly. But it was Friends Forever by La-Di-Da. And I did finish that, and it was for the same friend. So actually, she did get something that was for me. Yeah. And I just picked it up and did it. You know, I picked up linen. Outside of that wedding sampler and Ada, I just went straight to linen. I can't remember what, probably 32 count, I'm assuming. And, you know, just started stitching.
So that kit that went in the trash, did that at least hook you? Was that the door opener for you, or?
Yes, because it was like all in blues, and there were some pinks and yellows in it. It was so pretty. And I think it was the color combination and putting these colors onto a canvas of sorts, or, you know, a background. I just found that, you know, just a beautiful thing. Now, I might have not enjoyed the stitching so much, but I enjoyed the progress.
Yeah.
You know, I was like, oh, that looks good. Probably didn't, but, you know, at the time, that was really fascinating. And somewhere I ran out of steam, you know, and then she didn't know anything about it, which was fine.
Yeah.
So I didn't have to feel guilty. And, you know, like I said, eventually I was like, yeah, I'm never going to finish that. And just tossed it. One of the few things that I've just tossed out.
Yeah. Well, that's, you know, that's the I call it pressure stitching. Where you pick up a project and you got a deadline, and you may or may not really like it, but it's appropriate for whatever the event is.
Right.
And you're under the gun to get it done. And you either power through or you just, forget it.
Right. And so eventually I forgot it. And when I saw this Forever Friends by La-Di-Da, I was smitten. I mean, just like, oh, that is the best. And little did I know that those solid dresses, you know, take forever. I hung in there and you know, just kept stitching away, and I really enjoyed it. I just enjoyed it so much that I had a temporary job, because I was a mother of four, and so a friend of mine was managing one of those Christmas stores that opened temporarily, and she asked me if I wouldn't want to come and work a little bit, and I'm like, sure. And so I was going to this job, and it wasn't always busy. And I always took my stitching, you know, when it wasn't busy, I stood behind the counter and was cross stitching away. So eyes must've been a lot better than they are now. So,
yeah. So, but now, based on what I saw, particularly with your floss tubes, you have done an awful lot of stitching, or had done an awful lot of stitching before you started your company then.
No, well, I've done a fair amount. I am not a prolific stitcher by any means, probably because I like to start things, you know. So if I invested my time like I do now on one project, yeah, I would have a lot more done. But, you know, I have a ton of whips stored away.
I knew I liked you.
Yeah, okay.
I knew.
But now, yeah. Now I have to be disciplined and, you know, work on one thing at a time. So I have a variety of things that I have started and worked on, and, you know, some of them I have finished. So, yeah, I was doing a lot of stitching prior to starting to design.
Yeah. Well, that's all right. I do a lot of stitching too, but the finished pieces, yeah, not so much.
Mm-hmm. Not so much. Yeah. Well, now I have no choice. Now it's like, gotta get it done.
Yeah. Well, you created that for yourself. So
I did. I'm not terribly complaining about it. Let's put it that way.
So how did the, was it the sampler, the discovery and love of samplers that started your company, or was it designing? How did the company come about?
You know, and that's such an interesting and good question, because there's nothing I can pinpoint to, that was never a desire of mine, to be honest. I was in I told you I'd worked for a ministry, and I really felt like this was the job I was going to do until I retired, you know, but I was, you know, living in Europe, and it was, you know, back in the pandemic days when there was just a lot of cross-stitching hitting the market.
Yeah.
And a lot of people got into designing, and I thought, you know, I'm here in Europe, lots of access to samplers, which I didn't really explore prior. But then when I started digging, I'm like, oh, there's tons of them out there. I said, well, let me pick some up, because I'm pretty sure I can do some reproduction. Uh-huh. And honestly, let's be really transparent. My goal was to be part of market. I wanted to go to market to see everything. And I'm like, well, the only way I'm going to get to market is by, you know, starting my own company. And so that's what I did. I sort of made a plan. I looked for certain, actually in the beginning, I just bought what I liked, but then had to sit down and say, okay, what's a variety of samplers that I could tackle and get ready and present at market.
Mm-hmm.
And so I, you know, went through what I had and I sort of lined them up. And said, okay, I'll do this one, you know, and I sort of had I'll do this one first because it's easy. So as that was Martha Marcialis, she's a Spanish sampler. She's a Spanish red. So I did her first because I just needed to get my feet wet. How does a reproduction work? How does the program work? You know? And so that was very simple and sort of graduated. The second one I picked was, and Isabella Lee was my first sampler that I bought because I thought she was so charming and she looked like she would be very straightforward. She wasn't.
Oops.
Yeah, you know, what you see in the picture on an auction is sometimes very different than when you start digging, you know, into reproducing something. You're like, oh, this is not as straightforward as I thought. But so I did her second. And then, I did a Scottish sampler in between, which I released first. And then I went on to Beloved, where I thought I was going to lose my mind. That was a hard one to reproduce.
Yeah, we got to talk about that one. Oof.
Right. And then I picked up a sweet little German sampler, which I called my little sampler, because it had just initials on it, you know, nothing else. And I thought it was so cute for personalizing. So I reproduced her in a more contemporary color palette. It was a kind of a screaming young girl color palette when I got her. And I'm like, oh, well, you know, I'll do my own thing on that one. But faithfully reproduced her. And then the buttons. Yeah. You know, that was my selection for market. And I took a year and a half maybe to get ready. for market because I was working full time and I'm very slow stitcher. So, and I stitched everything myself. You know, so I was like, all right, I'm, this is the time frame I'm going to give myself to get ready and, just kept working. It's my goal.
That is a rough way to get to go to the Nashville market.
Yes. You know,
most people find a shop that they can tag along and help out just to get in the building. But no, you got to go the designer route. Oh, geez.
Right. I got to pave my own road. So,
we'll get back to the samplers in a minute. How did that, that's a first time at Nashville Market is a lot of guessing and do I have enough? Do I not have enough? And you got to have a space. I assume you shared with someone. Most people do.
I did.
That's a rough way to get into that building.
Holy smokes. Well, I had been in the building before once, twice, I think. I helped somebody way back when before I moved to Germany. And so I'd been there and just absolutely loved it. You know, it's just such a fantastic atmosphere.
Right.
And you're right. It is a really hard way. But, you know, as things work out, it was exactly the right thing for me, to be honest, because I ended up leaving my job. Things had changed dramatically, and I ended up with much trauma leaving my job at the end of last year. You know, and this was already rolling. And I was like, I'm just going to do this full time.
Uh-huh.
You know, and it worked out. And one of my friends keeps telling me every time I see her and, you know, every time I report in what's going on, she's like, isn't it a blessing that you don't work anymore? Because you could never have done, you know, this the way you're doing it now. And I'm like, you're absolutely right. You know, and it's such a pleasure and joy and privilege for me to be able to do this.
Yeah. Well, but that is cool. And you talk about God. Yeah. And it plays a role. Yeah, he does.
Absolutely. I think, you know, it was just prepared for me already, you know, and when I stopped my employment, you know, I just got the feeling like, hey, you are doing exactly what I want you to do right now.
Yeah.
And, you know, we'll talk about Beloved a little bit, you know, coming out with Beloved, you know, was just such a confirmation to me that I am exactly where I need to be now. And I dealt with a lot of terrible trauma in, not personally to me, but I worked for an organization that helps persecuted Christians in the countries where they're persecuted. And we were always bombarded with terrible, terrible news, you know, and it was just such a heavy burden. And I did that for 8 years with them. And, you know, I was talking to a friend of mine. And I said, I'm not sure this is okay because I feel very frivolous now, you know, just sitting here stitching and designing and reproducing. And she said, you know, just take that as a gift from God because, you know, you don't always have to work in a hard suffering type environment, you know, to please God. And I'm like, oh, maybe that's right. You know, maybe I get to do this for a while. I feel as long as he blesses it, you know, and as long as I feel like, yes, this is, you know, this is where I need to be, then I will continue to do so.
So have you become a sampler collector?
Oh, it's like potato chips. It's terrible.
Okay. All right. You're normal.
And, you know,
then.
You just don't stop looking for them. I'm like, just stop for a minute, you know, not that I'm buying them, but I'm looking at them all the time. And I'm like, don't stop, you know, just kind of, and then I'm thinking, no, but what if there's one that really is supposed to be mine and I miss it?
Yeah.
Anyway, you know, FOMO.
Yeah, no, you're normal. Yeah.
Okay.
I think every sampler reproducer that we've talked to, I'd not heard it described like potato chips, but yeah, same, Same story every time. Yep. Just
right. Right. You can't stop at yeah. one. You know, they come in and you get a closer look and it's so delightful.
Yeah.
You know, you find these little things that you didn't see on the photo and, you know, every one of them, it's like Christmas for me, you know, and especially when I start working on the reproduction and, you know, you really become intimately familiar with this, the work of the stitcher. You know, and it's just such a fun process, I think, frustrating at times, but really, really fun and revealing and delightful. And yeah, I think it's the best thing.
Yeah. All right. Now we got to learn about your design work, but I got to hear the story of this beloved sampler, because that is one standout piece. I'll tell you, when I saw that, it was like, whoa, got to have that one. I mean, that is special.
So I saw the sampler at an auction in Great Britain. Don't ask me, you know, I'd have to go back through my history on the auction houses to see where I actually got it from, which I should have done. And it was the red bird, because the female, the one below, had faded a lot, but the red bird was really sticking out. And then I was looking at it and I'm like, that is really a full sampler. You very rarely find that. I've not seen like a bird, like with the bird as a centerpiece and then have a whole sampler around it. And the colors were so neat. And I was like, okay, I got to have that one. And I honestly don't think it was a fortune by any means, you know, and so it came and you know, I admired it and I'm like, that's really cool. I said, I'm going to tackle that pretty early on. And I took it apart. And it was very interesting when I took it apart. In the back, there was a photo or a print of Queen Victoria was tucked in the back as padding. And then two other pieces of print, you know, prints. It had a framer. It had been framed, reframed, close to the turn of the century, and then, you know, from 18 to 19, in Edinburgh. So that's all. I mean, but it was fun to just take it apart. I have a photo of everything that was tucked in the back of the sampler. And it was my first wool sampler. I pulled it out and you know, was so enchanted with the front and then flipped it over the back and went, good golly. You know, wow, that was so bright. And you know, some of the colors were a surprise. And so I really had to work on how am I going to do justice to what the stitcher picked versus how it's faded. And yeah. I don't want to ignore what the stitcher picked altogether, but some of the fading was so beautiful. You know, so I sort of went a middle of the road. I kept some of the fading. I integrate, you know, I picked some of the colors from the back. And this is just what came together after I was done.
Yeah, that part is so interesting to me. Because, you know, we could probably group stitchers, sampler stitchers, into group, you know, a group that likes them to look old and dirty and faded.
Right.
And then, others who are kind of in the middle of the road, and then others want to see the garish colors, whatever the girls picked. They want, you know, want the full metal thing Yeah, that's me. I mean, I want to see what the original colors, you know, what got the girls excited, or what were they limited to using, and how did
right.
they use it?
Right.
And so when you get one of these things, that whole period of receipt until you get it opened and taken apart has got to be every time a unique experience, I would think.
You know, it is, because it really is always a surprise, or most of the time, it's a surprise what actually, if the color has survived on the back, because sometimes they don't.
Yeah.
You know, some of them don't, some of them do. Some of them are better at holding their values. It's always, you know, okay, the big reveal, you know,
yeah,
flip
right,
it over,
right.
See what we got in the back.
Right.
And I'm really a very casual, I'll say that, you know, casual reproductionist. I try to be as exact as possible, unless it's wonky and will drive people crazy if they stitch it that way. Mm-hmm. The girls a lot of times like to do, you know, offset stitches. Nobody wants to stitch offset stitches, you know, when you're in a groove. And it throws you off, you know, so I try not to do those. I really look more for, is this going to be an enjoyable stitch? Are the colors pleasing to the eye? You know, I try to be as true as possible, but if there's neon green, I'm not doing it. You know? And you know, screaming yellow, I'm like, let's no.
Yeah.
You know, I probably won't pick those up.
But that's the art of it to me, is as a reproduction person, a reproducer, making those calls to get, you know, stay true to the history, but still get a pleasing piece for people to stitch. I mean, that those little calls have to be interesting. At least I would find it interesting to watch and be there as you make those decisions. You know, like this mm-hmm. yellow simply can't be. We got to find something that's a little more muted.
Right.
But to me, that's the art of it. That, you know, so you come out with something that people will actually want to stitch and that can be stitched.
Right. So I really honestly, I mean, there might be reproductions out there that will disagree with me, but I sort of stand on the, hey, there is no accurate 100% true reproduction.
Uh-huh.
Because you're always struggling with the colors. Right. You may not get that, you know, you may get close to a color, but having looked through all your dyers, that color may not exist, you know, exactly on the dot. You may not, you know, it may have faded front and back. The fabric, who knows what it looked like, you
yeah,
know,
yeah, exactly.
in the beginning.
Yeah.
So in essence, I, you know, that takes a lot of pressure off. You know, I'm saying, I don't think you really actually, maybe a museum piece, you know, that has been absolutely cared for all its life, possibly. But the price range I fall in and a lot of other reproductionists fall in, I don't think there's such a thing as that an accurate, true reproduction, just because the colors, the materials we get to use today, you know, the mistakes that the girls make, you know, a lot of times they're just not incorporated. And if you do, you know, stitchers right. may not really appreciate that. There's right. a few that will, but I think the majority doesn't.
Yeah. Now, one of my favorite things whenever I look at stitching, if the stitcher will allow it, is to look at the back, because to me, that's where I learn how they move through the piece and how they handle the stitches. And to me, it's very educational, but I know for some people, it's like insulting that you would even ask to look at the back. But some of the old samplers I've seen, you know, that's just a riot on the back. And to me, that's the personality of the girl is to see how, you know, just carry this 4 inches across. Who cares?
Yeah. Or even more. And, you know, once I saw the backs of some of these samplers, I said, you know what? I'm never going to worry about my back again. I'm just not going to worry about it. You know, we ooh and ah over these and they are a hot mess in the back, you know, so I'm fine. I am totally fine.
Yeah. Well, and once you see that, you can understand a 9-year-old girl stitch this. She just wants to go play and, you know,
right.
just, yeah, whatever, yeah. whatever shuts mom up and lets me move on is good.
Yes. This is homework and I'm all done.
Yep. You know? Yep.
I've done it as fast as I possibly can. And yeah, I went over 3 here and I don't care.
Right.
Know?
Yep. So. Yep. Yep. Nobody cares. Yep. All right. So tell me the story of Beloved. I mean, how did you come about it? Because that is just beautiful.
Well, you know, one of the things that on the name, honestly, was I spend my quiet time every morning, or I endeavor to do it. It doesn't always work every morning, but you know, the majority of the mornings I'm reading the Bible and doing some sort of study. And as I was stitching this, and I listened to a daily Bible reading called Bible in a Year by Nikki with Nikki Gumbel. He's great. And I think I'm in my fourth year of doing that. And so we go through the entire Bible, but I can listen to it and stitch at the same time. And I was getting pretty close to having the birds done. And I was contemplating, like, I don't know what I should name this. And we happen to be in the Song of Solomon. And you know, he was, there's a, you know, my beloved, how beautiful you are. And you know, and I was like, oh, yes. That's what it's going to be, you know. It's going to be beloved, and it's just where I was at the time. You know, no big science, and actually no big thought. You know, that happens a lot. Also, the verses that come when I stitch a piece, and the verses that go on the actual pattern, you know, usually, you know, they just come at some point or another. I'm like, oh, I hear it, and I'm like, that is perfect for this piece that I'm stitching right now.
Yeah. So you get this piece from auction, and it's wool. How does wool hold up? I mean, do you have any idea how old the thing is?
No, there was no date, no you know, no mark whatsoever. The purple. So there's purple in the female bird. That was completely gray. You know, two very similar shades of gray, or maybe three, I don't know. But yeah, I don't know much about the sampler. You know, it's a typical, as I've looked at other samplers in general and wool samplers, this gray or bluish gray is very typical of a purple fade into, you know, to what it looks like today. I have another one I'm working on. It's a cotton and wool sampler. And what looks to be this beautiful, like, soft blue is actually quite a bright fuchsia.
Oh.
You know, and I'm like, that ruins my whole color palette, you know, that I was working on. I'm like, oh, if I put that in there, you know. But it was not a soft blue that I used. I did up the value into the pink range for that one. So you get more familiar, I think, with how things fade. You know, pinks and reds in a sample that's been exposed and, you know, hasn't had a lot of protection will always fade into a beige. Makes it really challenging. So you see those trees with like beige apples or, you know, lots of beige flowers on your sample. That probably was pink and red at some point or another, or, you know, something like that. You know, the house is very beige. That probably didn't start off as a beige house. So it's fun. I, you know, it's a little bit of sleuthing and getting familiar with, and I'm no sampler expert not at all, you know, low, bottom 5th percentile of what I know about samplers. But just spending time with them, you know, sort of gives you an idea of what the colors may have been at some point or another.
Do you find searching the history a necessity or something you enjoy?
I don't have the time for that. That falls into my husband's. So he does it, but I will sometimes jump in and dig a little deeper. I had this Dutch sampler by Magdalena van der Biel, and it's a beautiful big brick house. No house intimidates me anymore after I got done with that house. And somebody said, that house will keep you out of trouble. You know, if you like houses, that one is going to keep you out of trouble. And so I had her name. And there was a note attached to the back, which without that, I wouldn't have found anything on her, to be honest. And so we ended up on some Dutch sites finding information on her. And I was even able to supply it back to somebody that was doing a family tree And basically he had said, hey, if you have any information on, you know, anybody in this family tree, you know, additional, because here's what I have. And so I was able to email him and said, here's what I have. This is what I found. I said, and I also have her beautiful sampler. And I sent him a photo and he, you know, immediately replied, you know, thank you, and that he was going to update the site eventually.
So you helped him fill in some gaps as a result of the sampler. Wow.
Yes. Yeah, that was fun. You know, so I don't know. It's just a... This digging around and sleuthing, I wish I had more time to do it. I really don't. Like I said, my husband does it. And then I sometimes have to nudge him a little bit more like, hey, so maybe look here, maybe look there, see what else we can come up with, you know. But he's getting better at it. It's not like this needlework and trying to find people, you know, it doesn't come naturally, I don't think.
Yeah.
So, you know, he is working on it and sort of getting more of a feel like what is the kind of information we want to curate.
Yeah.
You know, for a sample, if we can.
Good to have that supportive spouse. Yeah.
He has been very, very supportive. I am very blessed by that. And, you know, couldn't do it without him, really, because he handles all the pattern making. So, you know, I send him the PDF and then he gets it ready for the printer. And there's a lot of work involved. And, you know, I was like, I don't have time for this, you know. And so, again, for him, it's a steep learning curve. You know, I know what it's supposed to look like. He has to learn all of this. But he is really, really, and he works full time. So he comes home at night.
Oh, wow. You know,
Yeah, what helps me out. So.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah.
All right, so your own designs, where did that enter the picture? Was that ahead of the samplers or after?
Totally after. So my motto, Gary, for the last 59 and a half years of my life, or, you know, however long, has been, I am not creative, but I can follow instructions mostly. Mm-hmm. You know, and so I've walked around basically knowing I'm not a creative person. I really am not, to be honest. And I was listening to Paulette from Plum Street Sampler one time, and she said, you know, she prays, like, make me, like, what's his name? I should have written it down. It's B-A-Z-L-E-L-E, I think. He was the guy way back in Exodus that was the creative supervisor on building the tabernacle for God in the desert when the Jewish nation was wandering the desert for 40 years. And, you know, the Holy Spirit gave him basically the knowledge and the skill to do goldsmithing, silver work, embroidery, you know, all those things. And, you know, I heard her talk about that and I'm like, you know what? That's not a bad prayer. Yeah. I'm going to incorporate that. And I will have to say, you know, whatever creativity I have seriously is a gift from God. You know, there's a saying I heard somebody once say, King David inquired and God inspired. And so that's sort of how I operate. I inquire and I wait for God to inspire. And that's my personal, you know, my own designs. Right. And there will be times when it's coming so fast, I have to write it down because otherwise it's too much info for me. And you know, there is all of a sudden this wellspring of creativity, and I am so grateful and just tickled pink as to what's coming out. And I just can't even, it's quite fun, I think, to see what's bubbling up in there. And you know, I have this goal of having somewhere between 15 and 20 designs in my computer ready to go by the end of the year, extra, beyond what I'm going to do. And I just need that cushion. I'm a safety planner person. So, and it's in there, You know, I counted the other day. I'm like, this, that. I'm like, wow, okay. You know, I just need to get it down into, you know, I need to get it in the computer, out of my head and off the paper.
Yeah.
And into the computer. Really fun. Quite fun.
That's so neat. Yeah. So, all right. So, Nashville in the spring here, are you deep in putting designs prep together work for that?
Yeah, I'm done with the design putting together. It's now just a matter of getting them stitched and done. I am going to be at Nashville. I will have to shout out Tracy Riffle from Hands to Work, who let me share her room with her last year. And I wouldn't be in this, you know, in the place I am now, if she hadn't so graciously opened her room up to me. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to be in the same room this year again, room 317, but this time without Tracy, which is very sad. But I think Tracy is taking a little break from market. So
you're going solo then.
Okay. I'm going solo, but I will say this, you know, I am a big pay it forward person. So if there's somebody that needs to squeeze in, then there's room in my suite. That's all I got.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the cool things is every year there's a good handful of new designers who get in that way by sharing with someone else and kind of get their foot in the door and get that experience. Because that first year has got to be one huge learning curve. You know, how many do I need? And I didn't have enough, and now I got to go home and print up a bunch and mail them. And yeah.
Right. Right. So I had my local needlework shop, which is Keepsakes, which is down in Cincinnati. So it's about 45 minutes away, but we'll call it still local. I told Barb, I said, you know, I'm really struggling with this particular aspect of it. How many?
Yeah.
You know, and she threw out a number on Beloved. And I was standing in front of Trader Joe's in the parking lot, and I think the whole parking lot heard me. And I was like, what? You know? And she's like, well, you don't have to do it. But that's how many I would print.
Yeah.
And so I was like, let me contemplate that. And I followed her advice and printed. I won't even tell you the number what I printed because it's huge. And I came home with maybe 100 left.
Yeah. So she was right.
She was right, you know, and I told her when she showed up, I'm like, you were right. And thank you so much. So, I think I was fortunate in some areas to get some really good advice on the volume of what I needed. And I didn't come home with too much at all.
That's the goal.
Didn't have to send out too much either. So I was really in a very sweet spot. Yeah, I don't know if I could do it again, but you're right. That is the most nerve-wracking, hardest, you know, agonizing thing you have to come up with is what number do I print and take?
Well, that's the whole thing. I mean, I've heard numerous stories. People, most instances, their first time, they didn't take near enough. And, and you know, Friday night, and then they're sold out for the big day Saturday, you know, which couldn't be worse. I mean, yeah, well, I can take your order when people are planning to haul them home. And, that's a tough spot to be in. So you got good advice there. Yeah. Yeah.
I really did. And, you know, I think I would probably go with the philosophy of print a little more than what you think you need, even though it's a financial commitment. It's going to be less than you having to reprint and mail them.
Yeah. Well, that's the tough call is exactly that, the financial layout to have that many without any knowledge of whether that's enough or too much. Yeah. Oh.
Right. And you can't guess, honestly, you'll get some indication on pre-orders, you know, what's a strong contender, but that still doesn't tell you.
Right.
How many you need to print. It really is. That's the hardest. And again, you know, you're laying out, it's a significant investment on your part.
Yeah. Yeah.
To bring all that merchandise to market.
Right. And count on coming home on Monday with enough cash to cover that. Yes.
right? Fingers crossed.
Yeah, know? No kidding.
That bill is going to come due, and you need to have that in your account. Yeah. Yep. Yeah, hopefully, you know.
So, all right. So full time, what do you plan a day? Like, do you structure your day or do you just let it flow? I mean, is there many hours of admin work and how does that work?
Yeah. Monday is admin day.
Okay.
I will try and push off all the admin I need to do to Mondays. My goal is to do a couple hours, you know, 2-3 hours of charting every day. to make progress. I stitch in the mornings, hopefully, till a certain time. You'll not hear me mention housework, okay? Let's just make that clear. I know, it's in there somewhere.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the dogs, I have two. You know, we take a walk. At some point, somewhere between, you know, 11 and 1 o'clock, we'll go for about an hour. We'll take a walk for about an hour. And then it's after one that I try to chart for a little bit, do housework a little bit. You know, my poor husband would like to come home to a dinner every once in a while. I used to cook all the time, you know, that's really a little harder for me now. And then once I get the dogs fed, dinner done, you know, kitchen semi-tidied up, it's back, sit back down and stitch some more.
Okay. So you have to keep the churn going then.
Yes. And I try to be pretty, pretty structured in my day because it really, the hours just slip by.
Yeah.
You know, before you know it, you're like, oh, I actually didn't get anything done, you know, that was on the schedule today. I looked at samplers. That's what I did.
You know, so. Gotta keep up. You might miss one. Yeah.
Right.
Is that what 2 to 3 hours of charting? Is that pretty much what the mind can handle before your eyes start crossing?
It depends on what you're charting.
Okay.
Honestly, like there are times when you can't get me away from the, you know, I'm like, I'm having so much fun charting and just go on and on and on and on, you know, and then I'll just say like, I'm not stitching today. I'm just going to chart until I'm, you know, it's time to go to bed. It likelihood is not a reproduction that has me so enthusiastic, even though I love reproductions. Those are just a lot harder, you know, on the eyes. They're just harder on the eyes. But if I'm working on my own design, I can go a long time.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I got to believe reproductions that
limits you as to, especially when they're on really fine linen, you know, and you're using readers, you know, so you're cheaters and you're using a magnifier.
Yeah.
You can see what's going on and you're counting.
There's got to be a lot of double and triple and quadruple checking to make sure you got it right.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes. And, you know, even then you're like, okay, I counted that 5 times and I counted it wrong 5 times. I don't know how that happens, you know, but this, I do the stitching the same way.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, please. So, so reproduction is just when I'm working on that, it's really a finite time that I spend with it.
Yeah. Have to control that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Sylvia, thanks so much. Wow. What a story. Most excellent. Thank you.
Well, it was fun, and I really appreciate you having me on. It's just a great, great industry to be a part of. And I am, like I said, I am just so grateful that I get to do this, you know, however long.
Hey, ride it to the hilt. Yep.
Yeah.
All right, Sylvia, thank you. And runningwithneedlesandscissors.com is the website. And thanks to everyone for listening.